Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing indications that President Trump is exhibiting signs of dementia, in addition to his obvious lack of impulse control, and get an assessment of if and when concerns expressed by White House insiders will lead to an intervention under the 25th Amendment. Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of the Yale School of Medicine, who was the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which Dr. Lee edited, emerged, joins us. We will discuss growing evidence that Trump is losing touch with reality and how his marked signs of volatility and attraction to violence could lead to a nuclear war with North Korea, and her call for an urgent psychiatric evaluation of the president by an independent panel of experts before he reaches for the nuclear button. Then we'll look into the rumored musical chairs about to take place in the Trump cabinet, with the CIA director Mike Pompeo elevated to head up the State Department once Rex Tillerson either quits or is fired, a shuffle which is likely to result in Republican freshman Senator Tom Cotton replacing Pompeo at the CIA. We will speak with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States State Department. She joins us to discuss the likelihood that there will be little change in U.S. foreign policy, which will continue to be damaging to the U.S. and dangerous for the world as long as Trump remains in the Oval Office. Then finally, we'll speak with the author of a new report at Public Citizen, The Koch Government, How the Koch Brothers' Agenda Has Influenced the Trump Administration. Alan Zibel, Research Director of Public Citizen's Corporate Presidency Project, joins us to discuss the extent to which the Koch brothers have been the main beneficiaries of what the Trump administration has achieved so far, and now are poised to be rewarded mightily by the so-called tax reform bill, which eliminates restrictions on tax-exempt foundations engaging in politics, meaning that the Kochs will soon be able to deduct the expense they incurred buying the United States government. And joining us now is Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She is lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited, emerged. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Bandy Lee.
Thank you very much for having me.
And there is something sort of growing out there in the zeitgeist in terms of concerns which you brought to the table with the Duty to Warn conference, the book, and I take it you've been sort of touring around the country, or you and your colleagues have. But now in the press, first of all, it's pretty clear from Trump's recent behavior that something is dreadfully wrong. But now it seems like insiders in the White House are now expressing concerns. So are we on a path towards the 25th Amendment being invoked?
First of all, if I may, please let me say I'm speaking on my own behalf and not representing the views of my institutions. That is Yale University, Yale School of Medicine, and Yale Department of Psychiatry. We are actually advocating for an emergency evaluation based on what the 25th Amendment allows. In other words, the fourth section allows for at least temporary removal of a president to be able to be evaluated. And I think we have come to that point. We had previously been advocating for an expert panel that could evaluate all presidential candidates and presidents to come. But now I think is the time for really an urgent evaluation. And we will be visiting Capitol Hill next week and next month to be able to advocate for this.
So in terms of the manifestations of erratic behavior, of, well, I guess the things that concern me and clearly concern you. In the letter that you wrote to the New York Times, psychiatrists warned about Trump's mental state is not just the signs of volatility and his unpredictable behavior, but an attraction to violence. And that's been clear throughout the campaign and, you know, get him out and calling for them to boot out protesters. And in general, there's a sort of glee. And by the way, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but in the first briefings that Trump was given at Trump Tower in the transition, which is a ritual that the State Department provides all these briefers that do a sort of round robin about what's happening in the world to bring the president-elect up to speed, apparently he wasn't interested in what anybody had to say. He kept asking them what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. So he's got some peculiar fixation about nuclear weapons. And with his personality and his propensity to violence, that is just absolutely, it's unsupportable, surely.
Yes, yes, that is why we are as concerned as we are. I mean, it's unprecedented in American history that this many mental health professionals are coming forth to warn the public and to express their concerns. The 27 in the book are just the tip of the iceberg, as you probably noted. We are in the hundreds and thousands, and this has never happened under any president of any party. So it really speaks to the patterns of mental impairment that we are seeing and the types of impairment, because their mental illness can be as varied as physical illness. Someone who is mentally ill is not necessarily unfit or dangerous. In fact, most mentally ill individuals are not any more dangerous than ordinary individuals. It's the particular symptoms and the severity of the symptoms and the situation that the person is in that make them dangerous. And I'm afraid that we're seeing all those things in extremity with this president, and that he has the very particular characteristics that would make one dangerous and not just attracted to violence, but in many ways can only resolve the internal conflicts through violence from their point of view. And then we have the situation of this person being in the office of the presidency with the world's most powerful nuclear arsenals and at his disposal. So the risk, in fact, is staggering if you began to think about it. I think most people have been unable to think about it because those who can see it are numbed by the magnitude, and those who are unsure would rather deny and deflect than face this reality. I think it's about time that we really do face the situation. It's become too critical now. It's always been risky from the start, but what the signs we're seeing are signs of decompensation, someone disintegrating because he's unable to cope, and his coping mechanisms will tend toward violence.
Well, he is a con man, right? And how much do con men somewhere in the recesses of their personality have a conscience? In other words, do they know they're conning and that the con will catch up with them?
In extreme cases, no. No, they won't have a conscience, and they will have very little empathy. And in fact, from early on, what people were mistaking as his being very clever or skillful, having a brilliant strategy, that was actually more patterns of impairment. When the impairment is so severe, of course it'll be effective. Of course it'll achieve its goals, but the goals are not the individual's goals. It's usually destruction and often bringing about hastened death. And that's the definition of disease versus health. And so what many of us have been seeing are actually patterns of severe impairment, where he is not even able to see other individuals as independent human beings, where he is not able to consider others or consider even consequences, or even be able to go to a place where he isn't totally right or the strongest and smartest and best. There's a reason why he's been going there because of the level of his fragility. And that's what he's been masking. And unfortunately, the public had been unaware and uneducated in psychological matters to the point where they saw what were unhealthy defenses as actually skillful maneuvering. And I'm afraid that the patterns do not indicate that to be the case.
So, Dr. Lee, then it's true, it's a dangerous combination. Somebody that's internally frail, but externally ebullient and bellicose and belligerent. But in terms of the kind of decompensation that you're talking about, because of his extreme narcissism, is the insecurity that he's so out of his depth with this job that he may not have even wanted. He may actually have been out there just to promote himself, because after all, he's a salesman and a real estate developer, and he's promoting.
Yes, he could not have done otherwise.
Right. He was promoting his brand. But he also, of course, was a reality TV star. And in effect, we do have a reality television show coming out of the White House. So I'm not entirely sure that he's completely falling apart, or that it's just government by stunt because he doesn't know what he's doing and it's eventually going to catch up with him.
Well, I think you're attributing conscious choice here as opposed to reacting because the pressures are mounting and he doesn't know what to do. Under ordinary circumstances, we see a difficulty coping with ordinary criticism or unpleasant news. And here we have a major investigation moving forward. North Korea is continuing to threaten. His popularity ratings have plummeted. I think what you're speaking about are what ordinary persons with enough internal resources to cope with this, to think of other areas of life, to be able to withstand some of these pressures would do or think. I am not sure he has that capacity. But that is the reason why a full evaluation is so necessary, because we have had no opportunity to test his ability to distinguish reality from falsehood, from his ability to take in information or advice and to be able to manipulate it, to consider possible different scenarios and to make fact and reason-based decisions, thinking about consequences. We don't know that he has that capacity. And actually, over time, through his multiple reactions to situations in real time that we've observed over quite a bit of time, actually suggests that he is rather remarkably lacking in that ability. And his behavior, whereas it might appear unpredictable to others, it's very predictable in terms of patterns of impairment or patterns of pathology. So I think we really need an examination to confirm and to assess the level of impairment, but I think the signs are actually considerably marked, and if it were anyone other than the president, we would have confined him and examined him long ago. It's only because he's in the office of the presidency that we have not been able to do so and let this go on for many months. But I think, I mean, the facade will gradually fall apart, but can we really wait until that happens? What mental health experts could probably tell you is that his condition is worse than it appears, far worse considering the depths and even the power of the mind to overtake someone and drive someone, that he is, and all the hopes that he will get better, there's nothing to validate that. He will assuredly get worse, and soon we're not going to be able to manage it. So I think the sooner that we can do this evaluation, the better, for the sake of our safety and our survival.
Well, I'm just processing what you've just told us, Dr. Lee, but the idea, I take it, what you're telling us is that to be mentally ill doesn't mean that you have to be wandering around the streets telling the world that you're Jesus Christ or something like that.
Exactly. That would actually be less dangerous.
Right.
That would be less dangerous, and that is others' notion, the ordinary person's notion of someone who's mentally ill, but it doesn't, you know, it's not the only manifestation.
Right. So in other words, he's a degree away from that, but he's suppressing that outward manifestation. And that this internal struggle that he goes with is exacerbated when he's under stress, which he is because he has a stressful job and he's completely out of his depth and doesn't know what he's doing.
Yes, I mean, the ordinary pressures of this presidency would be great enough, but for him especially to be under investigation and for him to be an unpopular president and for him in particular to be facing these pressures and continual checking and rechecking of reality. Others will not just buy his word for what things are and will not be bullied into believing what he wants everyone to believe. And so he's constantly checked and challenged in this position. And he unfortunately doesn't seem to have the mental equipment to deal with this. So a gradual unraveling is something that we have predicted, and the book was put together 7 months ago, and you will see that everything that we predicted is unfolding. And there are patterns to these impairments. I, as you know, have devoted my career to studying violence, to studying, predicting, and preventing violence. And so I have actually seen my patient base is, in fact, individuals just like Mr. Trump. It's very rare to see such individuals out in the ordinary everyday life, let alone the presidency. I ordinarily see them in jails and prisons. The behavior is actually quite predictable because the person has so few resources that they tend to behave in the same way, and the way they project themselves will be as very strong, very confident, and very very sure of themselves. But actually, that is just a veneer, as you said, and it's masking severe levels of inferiority, inadequacy, feelings of low self-worth, and powerlessness. And emptiness, and the degree of that can be seen by just how little he can tolerate criticisms, challenges to his being the best and the most popular and the brightest. He can't handle any of that, and a lot of that also inhibits him from learning new information, because in order to learn information, he has to admit to himself that he does not know something. He's not even able to go there. So he ends up being unable to learn. And given how little he is revealed to know, it's been a pervasive pattern since very early on. And these types of impairments do start rather early on and tend to be very chronic. That's not to say that they are any less severe than the person who's running around the street saying they're Jesus Christ. In fact, what we see in times of stress is possible equal levels of decompensation. I mean, when they decompensate, they do become psychotic, that is, losing touch with reality and becoming quite dangerous. And what we're seeing, I believe, in terms of his specific going back on his admission and apology about the sexual
Access Hollywood
admission,
right,
and his going back to conspiracy theories, I believe, is a part of that decompensation, losing touch with reality.
Well, just in the last minute, Dr. Bandy Lee, the 25th Amendment, of course, requires those close to him, including the Vice President, to make this judgment. And so far, we have to assume that they know more than we do, and they've witnessed more of this unstable and dangerous behavior, but they're covering up. So what will it take? Does he have to be literally, you know, with the choice between the 25th Amendment and the Mueller investigation, it seems to be the choice whether he's taken out of the Oval Office in a straitjacket or in a orange jumpsuit.
Well, first of all, criminal responsibility has usually very little to do with mental illness. His being mentally impaired does not exonerate him from criminal responsibility, but being impaired in that way and criminal-minded at the same time makes one more dangerous. And so we have to think of both of them together in terms of national and international security. Because for me as a mental health professional, the Mueller indictments actually indicate a psychological emergency. They are conditions for a more dramatic breakdown than what we have seen. And so we have to be prepared for that. What we're trying to do at this point is educate as much as possible, as fast as possible. We will be visiting several Congress members next week. There is going to be a very influential Congress member holding a policy dinner on this topic, inviting dozens of Congress members. So even though I was initially invited to testify before Congress, that hasn't happened yet. Through the initiative of others, we're actually going to be visiting lawmakers ourselves early on. We're trying our best also to educate the public because they need public support to be able to act. And we're also reaching out to military members. A grave problem is that many people continue to be uninformed about psychological matters, do not perceive the gravity of it, that it can be just as debilitating, if not more, than physical illness because it's not so obvious and mm-hmm. some symptoms people may just not recognize and allow the pathology to act as if it were the person's decision-making.
Well, Dr. Bandy Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of the Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She is lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited, emerged. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the rumored musical chairs about to take place in the Trump cabinet.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the U.S. Department of State. She has worked in human rights and economic development in India, Israel, and Eastern Europe, and has served as an election monitor in Pakistan and Bangladesh. And her upcoming book is The Savage Order. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Thanks so much, Ian.
So what do you make of this musical chairs that's about to take place in the White House? the plan that they have to force out Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is being leaked, and some people think that it's being deliberately leaked by General Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, because Trump is reluctant to fire people in spite of all of his sort of "you're fired" bluster, apparently. And this is a way for Kelly to sort of send a signal to Tillerson that it's time to go. If that's the case, then we're told that Mike Pompeo, the former congressman, now head of the CIA, will take Tillerson's job. And then in turn, the freshman senator from Arkansas, Tom Cotton, will take Pompeo's place at the CIA. So what do you make of the shuffle?
Well, as you said, this is what's known in D.C. as a trial balloon, and it's just a classic one. You leak what you think should happen, hear the fallout, make your final decision after that point. So I don't think any of these decisions are finalized, but I think you're spot on with what Kelly is trying to do. And I don't think it's necessarily wrong, particularly in the case of Tillerson. Now, I have huge disagreements with both men, Cotton and Pompeo, who are coming in, and I think they both can be quite problematic. So we can get into the substance of who's replacing in a minute. But Tillerson has been uniquely destructive to the State Department. He's also been incredibly ineffectual. Once you lose the trust of the commander-in-chief and you're speaking with different voices, not only does state not have a say in policy decisions, but you also have your allies and your enemies not believing what state's saying or being very confused about who's sending what signal. So I think Kelly's right that it's time for Tillerson to go for a whole host of reasons. Now, whether these are the men that should be replacing him is a whole other question that we should discuss.
Well, but for anybody in that job, it has to be a nightmare, particularly from the early days when anybody could wander into the Oval Office, you know, whether it's the bodyguard was sort of basically the conduit and the kids had the rights to come in at any time. And now, of course, one of the kids, the son-in-law, has more portfolios than Rex Tillerson. So it's been pretty humiliating from day one for a pro, hasn't it?
So I think you're quite right about the humiliation, but there's something else going on with Tillerson, which is that horrific as many people find Pompeo's policies, a lot of the State Department is looking forward to Tillerson going. And that tells you something. It was more than just Trump sidelined him. Tillerson's been leading a dismantling of the State Department, really a downsizing. 2,000 of the most senior diplomats are gone, including people who are crucial for security. You know, Pompeo was one of the big speakers about the Benghazi crisis and all the things that Secretary Clinton did wrong. Well, the lead person in charge of security to prevent that in the future has left under Tillerson. So the amount that the State Department has been hollowed out and downsized under Tillerson and the demoralization that comes from that, because nobody's going to argue that the State Department didn't have some fat, but this guy is cutting a lot of flesh, means that the department itself is cheering his leaving in many, many places. So I don't think this is not a black and white issue in terms of his going. It is more difficult when you look at the replacements.
So what was it all about in Tillerson's mind, or what prompted his actions? Was it just some kind of corporate hubris that, you know, you can reorganize these government bureaucracies just like an oil company? What was he thinking?
You know, I can't plumb the depths of Tillerson's psyche. I'm not that familiar with this man, but I think he got some signals from Trump that Trump wanted state cut, and that's clear in the budget. Now, Trump also doesn't like to take the blame for things, so when things started going wrong, it could be that Trump wants to make him a scapegoat. I think there is a real feeling among many business people that if government was run like a business, it would be better, and one of the things businesses do is cut costs and downsize. Now, in a business, there's a bottom line. Are your revenues greater than your expenses, and are you making money? And so cutting costs makes a lot of sense. In the world of diplomacy, it's a whole different matter, because ultimately, if you do your job well, America gets stronger and you prevent wars. And so wars are incredibly costly. So you're looking at a couple of unknowns when you look at your cost sheet, and it just doesn't make sense to downsize for the sake of downsizing, which is what it looked like Tillerson was doing. I think he was really following a spreadsheet that said conservatives don't like state. They tend to think that it is wishy-washy. Trump wants to cut costs and wants to cut government, and his conservative base wants that. And so I'm going to cut costs and cut government without thinking that in government, if you cut costs on certain things, such as war prevention, costs on the other side of the ledger go up in terms of fighting. So so I think there was clearly some hubris there.
So we're told that Mike Pompeo, the former three-term member of Congress, who you pointed out was a big proponent of the Benghazi witch hunt, he apparently has impressed President Trump by giving him the daily intelligence briefings. And the rumor is that he's sort of a little unctuous and very ambitious. And apparently it's no great state secret that the way to get on with Trump is to flatter him and indulge him. And he did that by Pompeo, at Trump's urging, talked to a former NSA official who has this bizarre conspiracy theory that the DNC hack was conducted by an American intelligence insider. So to my mind, when you have an inexperienced and perhaps even mentally unstable president, the last thing you want in there are sycophants who indulge him. The people you need around him are people who can constrain him and educate him.
Well, now we get to the nub of the problem, which is that this president seems to only allow sycophants to be in power, except generals. He does seem to make something of an exception if you have a lot of stars on your shoulders. But he's only going to let yes men be close. And so what do you do in that situation? Who could you possibly push forward? Because you're going to get that situation with all of your potential appointees. Pompeo is smart. I mean, he was the editor of the Harvard Law Review. You don't get that post by being a dope. So in that way, he at least brings some intellectual heft to the position. However, his own friendlies in the intelligence community have said of him that he likes certainty. He doesn't like questions. He really wants answers when a job is about ambiguity. And that's a huge problem in the intelligence world, where everything you get is in shades of gray, and you have a president who tells you, I only want consensus views, I don't want to hear anything else. It's also a huge problem at the State Department, where much as many of us like a more black and white world, you're dealing with really difficult problems. I mean, take Iran, which Pompeo has been very loud about his views on the Iran deal and how bad it is and how he wants to roll it back. Iran is a noxious terrorist regime. And Iran sponsors terrorism. It sponsors human rights abuse. It kills people who are gay and locks up protesters. And no one's going to argue that this is a good country. And it's a large country. And what it does matters. On the other hand, if it has nuclear weapons, what will happen to the rest of the region? How many other countries will go nuclear? What will happen to our ally in Israel? And so on. You're dealing with difficult situations, and you have to be able to balance ambiguity. And so a man who can't do that and doesn't like to do that is a dangerous man to put at the head of your diplomatic section.
Well, in terms of Senator Cotton going to the CIA, already, as I mentioned earlier, there was a lot of disquiet amongst the CIA professionals about Pompeo meeting with the NSA official with the conspiracy theory about the DNC hack being conducted by an American intelligence insider. That was apparently upset a lot of people. But in general, you're hearing that intelligence officers think that Pompeo was far too political. Cotton is about 10 times more political, isn't it? I mean, yep. If they're worried about this guy, the next one is a complete catastrophe for them, isn't it?
I agree completely. I mean, both of them are Harvard Law grads, by the way, as a Yalie. I want to point that out. But, you know, so neither of them is dumb. However, Cotton is incredibly partisan and incredibly political and also likes his certainty. And so, you know, I'll stick with Iran because I've already been discussing that situation. Cotton is the one who spearheaded the letter from Congress, from Republican congressmen, to the Ayatollah, the man in charge in Iran, saying Barack Obama as president doesn't have the power to negotiate this agreement. Now, everyone knows the Senate has to approve all treaties, so in that way it's fair. But the man in charge of our country's intelligence writing to a foreign leader our country is in the midst of negotiating with to undermine our own president's position, that's the man we're going to put in charge of our state secrets? It is incredible.
But it's an anathema, though, to the intelligence professionals to have ideologues in charge, because the whole idea of intelligence is, as far as I understand, and in some ways it also applies to journalism, is that you have to be skeptical, open-minded, in effect, I hate to use the L word, but liberal in the traditional sense of the word, open-minded, skeptical, inquiring, not rigid and certain.
That's right. I mean, I used to work for Jim Woolsey, who was the director of national intelligence many years ago toward the end of the Cold War, right after the end of the Cold War. And Jim and I disagree on many things. I mean, he's a huge proponent of starting the Iraq War, for instance. But he's been a backer of Trump, which we also disagree about. However, as a personality, he's skeptical and inquisitive. And you know, that's the kind of person who, whether or not I agree with their policy positions or their politics, that's the sort of person you want in charge of your intelligence for all the reasons that you say. Because all you get in intelligence are raw, unverified reports from individuals who are giving you that information for a reason, or SIGINT, signals intelligence, which has to be interpreted. What does it mean that this person is talking to this person, that they're saying this thing? Is it misinformation that they're trying to give you? Is it trying to put you in the wrong track? Are they trying to use the United States to fight a domestic battle for themselves and get themselves more power vis-a-vis someone else? You have to have that kind of skeptical mindset, and neither of these men do, but Cotton is, I would argue, more problematic than Pompeo.
Well, just in closing, of course, Woolsey's playing an important role in the General Flynn situation, having witnessed, or in part, what appears to have been a bizarre attempt on Flynn's part to oblige Turkish government, who were paying him tons of money, suggesting that somehow they could do a sort of rendition of the troublesome cleric, at least in terms of Erdogan, out of the country, kidnap him and send him off to Turkey as a favor, a $15 million favor, I might add, to Erdogan. That's an extraordinary situation. And so just in closing, what do you think? It seems so much that what went on with Flynn, both during the transition and into his very short tenure, is that what the special prosecutor is looking at. And when you add together what Sally Yates has hinted at and what we know about so far, is your sense that that is really going to crack open this situation, or perhaps even maybe it's the be-all and end-all, but most people think that it will be the beginning of a pretty explosive revelation on the part of the special prosecutor?
Yeah, let me say three things about that situation. First, once Flynn starts talking, he has a lot to say. And so we are certainly going to find out much, much more about the level of dirtiness here. And I do believe that there is a lot of fire behind this smoke. On the other hand, I think that people who are opposed to this administration are doing themselves a huge disservice by spending so much of their thought on the Russia investigation. We have a good man who for now has a job, who is doing a very good role on this investigation. And what those of us who are citizens need to do is pay attention to some of the other issues where this administration is harming our democracy. Flynn's money that he was getting from Turkey is a case in point. The level of outright corruption, pure plutocracy in this current tax bill that we're seeing, and payoffs from foreign governments to the Trump hotels and so on, that is corrosive to a democracy. When your country stops believing that the politicians are out for anything but self-enrichment, and the amount of money is the amount that we're seeing, that will destroy democracy long after Trump himself is gone. And so I think we need to let our man in charge of the investigation do his work. He's a great, great, thoughtful guy, and the rest of us need to be focused like a laser on what we can do to save the other institutions of our democracy. And on that, I would say, you know, we can spend a lot of time talking about the horrors of Trump's cabinet picks and what they're going to do. But ultimately, the best way to stop this juggernaut, and I speak not as a partisan here, I speak really as a small D Democrat, as someone who cares a lot about where our country is going and is pretty afraid right now when I look at it. We need to vote, and we need to build institutions that can withstand this kind of assault on them, and those are things we can do as citizens.
Well, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, the Senior Associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and was appointed to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and has worked on human rights and economic development in India, Israel, and Eastern Europe, and has served as an election monitor in Pakistan and Bangladesh, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. And her upcoming book is The Savage Order. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the author of a new report at Public Citizen, The Koch Government, How the Koch Brothers' Agenda Has Influenced the Trump Administration.
To buy the Cokes a world so they leave ours alone, then go back to Park Avenue and crawl beneath their stone.
I'd like to teach the Cokes about a true democracy. Where working class meets corporate ass, proceed to shining.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alan Zibel, who's a research director of Public Citizen's Corporate Presidency Project, who previously covered financial services regulation and housing for the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Newswires. He's the author of a new report at Public Citizen, The Koch Government, How the Koch Brothers' Agenda Has Influenced the Trump Administration. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Zibel.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Alan. And here we are, just as the Senate is about to pass this so-called tax reform package, which is a massive gift to the Koch brothers and will, in fact, empower and consolidate plutocratic rule in this country at the expense of our tattered democracy. But I guess in a way, the chaos that we focus on a daily basis, at least I do, in trying to keep up with Donald Trump and his antics, distract us from the fact that so far in the Trump administration, the real winners, if not the only winners, have been the Koch brothers. And now you have a report that bears that out.
Yeah, I mean, this has really been, a decades-long campaign by the Koch brothers to change policy, you know, through the creation of what people, you know, somewhat jokingly call the Kochtopus, their network of groups, and I think, the evidence is that the Koch brothers initially were pretty spooked by Trump during the campaign. They didn't really like him. Charles Koch, famously said that choosing between Trump and Hillary was like choosing between having a heart attack and getting cancer. But you know, once Trump got into office, they have been able to staff his administration with a lot of their people. It's what we document here is 44 people in the administration that have a fairly strong tie to the Koch brothers. This has a lot to do with the fact that Trump, didn't really have that many aides or really anybody who, or very few people connected to him that knew much about policy. And the Koch brothers, had spent years and years building up, all of these political aides and policy aides to implement what they want to do. And I think we're going to see that tonight on the tax bill.
Well, it's worth noting, surely, that David Koch attended Trump's election night party in Trump Tower, along with the Trump family and Peter Thiel, a very tight group, a small family group. So the fact that he was included is significant. Also, of course, David Koch had an informal chat with Trump at Mar-a-Lago on December the 21st, where apparently they talked about preparations for his administration. And your studies indicated that the administration has basically been, it's almost the Koch brothers administration. 44
Absolutely.
Officials now from the Koch brothers are essentially running the Trump administration. And it's pretty clear that Trump doesn't know what he's doing. So he, in a way, isn't Trump a perfect candidate for a plutocrat who has contempt for government, who's a rabid libertarian who wants to basically destroy government and allow the private sector to run everything and go back even, you know, before the Gilded Age? Not that.
Yeah, and I would say that Trump is fairly, it seems to be fairly ideologically malleable, to put it maybe politely. I mean, he did, you know, even during the campaign, he kept on saying things like, oh, I'm going to build a better health care system and I'm going to take care of more people. And all this stuff that I'm sure made Charles and David Koch upset, but they've, you know, been able to I think outsmart him and influence him to the point where he, you know, has not carried out virtually any of those promises. He's gone back on you know almost anything that seemed to have. Non-traditional or not hard right bent. The exception would be trade, right? I mean, the Kochs are not big fans of his position on trade. Immigration, they disagree with him on immigration. But on the, by and large, they've been able to kind of subsume his agenda for theirs.
Well, of course, the other explanation is that Trump is simply a cynical liar who told the people on the stump what they wanted to hear, and then when he became president, became the Wall Street president, the very people he ran against.
Yeah, the most significant players here are Mike Pence and Mark Short, who's the White House Legislative Affairs Director, who is, you know, who was Pence's chief of staff and a long time head of a Koch group, Freedom Partners, and had worked for the Kochs for years. I think he actually worked for Koch Industries for a time. Mark Short has really been the Koch's key person on tax reform, and he had a forum here in Washington over the summer where it was Mark Short and Tim Phillips, who's the head of Americans for Prosperity, and Steve Mnuchin, and they were doing this event called Unrig the Economy here at the museum in D.C., and it was fairly, you know, bizarre that one person who works for the Koch brothers, another person who used to work for the Koch brothers. You know, Steve Mnuchin has his chief of staff used to work for the Koch brothers. Mnuchin had them invest in some of his movies. So he doesn't have as quite of a direct tie as these guys, but it's just very kind of. A lot of the arrows in the Trump administration do point to this, to the Koch brothers, which is an incredible amount of power for just two guys. I mean, two incredibly rich guys, but two guys that have, essentially created their own political party that's to the right of the Republican Party, but it's, gradually taken over the Republican Party. So it's quite a remarkable situation the more that you dig into it.
Now, as far as I can tell, obviously this so-called tax reform will be a massive gift to the Koch brothers. The fact that a part of it, of course, is repealing the estate tax, which will mean that these vast fortunes will be passed on to heirs and create kind of American plutocratic dynasties as opposed to the incentive that the estate tax gives to the wealthiest Americans to engage in philanthropy, which has created, you know, the Rockefeller Fund and the Ford Foundation, etc., all of which have done a great deal of good. So as bad as that is, already a lot of what, if you look at what has been passed by the House, very little, most of it in terms of changing regulations, which your organization, Public Citizen, has been on top of. So, you know, when you look at the gifts to the Koch brothers, it's just extraordinary. The EPA being crippled by a Koch protege as the head of the EPA, opening up offshore drilling, the tar sands pipeline from Canada, pulling out of the climate accords, the Paris Accords. All of this is absolutely a gift to the Koch brothers. So am I correct in looking at this broader picture that not only are the Kochs about to be rewarded enormously by this so-called tax reform bill, they've already been rewarded, haven't they, by this administration?
Yeah, a couple things there. I mean, so they, you know, their lead group, Americans for Prosperity, you know, has been very active in the tax reform debate. And one of the things that that people don't know about is a sort of a little known, less known provision in the tax bill that would allow 501c3 nonprofits to do partisan politics, which they're technically, you know, which they're not allowed to do. So we're repealing what they call the Johnson Amendment would actually benefit Americans for Prosperity and a lot of the Koch's 501c3s and let them, you know, do partisan electioneering with tax-deductible donations. So it would make the Koch brothers' advocacy, you know, tax-deductible. Another piece of it that's interesting is, you know, the Koch brothers have already had a lot of success in getting their agenda passed, as you mentioned. I mean, I looked through in this report a list of items that they put out in January, and they've done most of these things have happened. I mean, they executive order putting a moratorium on new federal coal leases that was rescinded. You know, the Paris climate agreement, as you said, you know, that is Trump announced that would be exited. You know, there tons of things. I mean, they had aides that were very in the weeds on policy and the law, and they were able to go to Congress with an agenda. I mean, they've succeeded by, being smarter and being more on top of things than the sort of bare bones staff that the Trump people came in with.
Now, you just mentioned the Johnson Amendment, 1953 law that's about to be repealed. It's a part of this so-called tax reform bill, and obviously has no real part in it, but this is what the religious right apparently are the champions of this. And it's a law that meant to stop churches from proselytizing and using the pulpit as a political weapon. They've obviously pushed the envelope a lot on that. So primarily it's being reported out as a gift to the evangelicals, but you just made the case that it's really a gift to the Koch brothers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is an issue that we, a Public Citizen, follow very closely. We have a whole coalition called the Bright Lines Project that has been working on this issue and trying to fight the good fight on that issue. I can be honest, and it doesn't really look good. But the goal is to maintain this ban on political activity for nonprofits, and it would 501c3 charities. The Kochs tend to have, Americans Press for Prosperity has a C3 and a C4, and, you know, they have a bunch of different legal organizations. But this would make everything tax deductible. Any donation to a C3 would continue to be tax deductible. But you could, do some of the things that you can do in the C4 now in the C3. Partisan electioneering.
In other words, what you're telling us is that the Koch brothers, who've already bought our government and are getting faithfully served by the Republican Party, they, in buying the government, they also can buy it tax-free. The money they spend on buying our government is a tax deduction.
It would appear to be the case. I mean, that you know, there may be some limitations there, but it's certainly not good. You know, we're very concerned about it, yes.
Well, it's just extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, at what point do the American people wake up, and I don't know who's going to tell them that, you know, forget about it. We're not a democracy anymore. We're a plutocracy. That is just absolutely the unassailable objective facts. I mean, so all of this sort of patriotic jingoism and freedom, and of course the Kochs use freedom all the time. That's their buzzword. Freedom for them to pollute and make money and not have any regulations and not pay taxes. But for the rest of us, it's a form of slavery.
I mean, I think there is hope. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, unfortunately, I do think this tax bill is going to pass. But I do think that, you know, when people start seeing that it was a bill of goods and that their taxes are going to go up, you know, that what was pitched as a tax cut didn't actually help them, and conferred huge benefits on huge companies, you know, I think people, that's not going to sit well for people. I think we'll see some changes in 2018. The Koch brothers paint Americans for Prosperity as a quote-unquote grassroots group. I mean, I just don't think that there really actually is any sort of true grassroots movement for corporate tax cuts. I mean, I think that some of their messaging just really, rings hollow or rings, very contrived. And that I think that people just are not clued into it. I mean, it's AstroTurf, right? It's pretend grassroots lobbying, and they send letters to Congress, and they make it look like it's coming from five different groups, but it's all them. I mean, they've got a Koch brothers group, Generation Opportunity for kids, for young people. They've got a group for Latinos, the Libre Initiative. They got Americans for Prosperity. They've got Freedom Partners, but you know, like they're all saluting to the same two guys, it's an ingenious strategy and very, very troubling.
Well, just in closing, Alan Zibbald, our audience need to get hold of your new report at Public Citizen, the Koch government, how the Koch brothers' agenda has infiltrated the Trump administration. How do they get it?
Yeah, the easiest way to find it is if you go to a site that we set up called Corporate Presidency, just corporatepresidency.org/Koch. And you can see it right there. I have a blog and a fun video that boils it down. And I really appreciate the time to talk about it.
And again, I've been speaking with Alan Zibbald, who's a research director of Public Citizen's Corporate Presidency Project, who previously covered financial services regulations and housing for The Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones and Newswire. He's the author of a new report at Public Citizen, The Koch Government, How the Koch Brothers' Agenda Has Influenced the Trump Administration. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.